Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, translation and commentary by Sivan Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. A reading today from the fourth canto, chapter 29, text 29. Kvachit, Puman. Quachit cha stri quachit novayam andalihi devo manusha tiryak va yatakarma gunam babaha quachit puman quachit cha stri Chinnovayamandari Deva Manushya Tiragva Itarkama Gunan Babaha Quachit Puman Quachit Quachit Puman Quachit Chashri Quachinnovayamandari Deva Manushya Stiryagva Itakama Gunam Bhavaha Quachit Puman Quachit Chashri Quachin Novayamandadihi Deva Manushya Stiryagva Karma Gunam Bhavaha Quachit. Sometimes. Puman. Male. Quachit. Sometimes. Cha. Also. Stri. Female. Quachit. Sometimes. Na. Not. Ubayam. Both. Blind. Dihi. He whose intelligence. Devaha. Demigod. Manushaha. Human being. Tiryak. Animal, bird, beast. Va. Or. Yata. According to. Karma, of activities, gunam, the qualities, bhavaha, birth. Translation. Covered by the mode of ignorance and material nature, the living entity is sometimes a male, sometimes a female, sometimes a eunuch. Sometimes a human being, sometimes a demigod, sometimes a bird, an animal, and so on. In this way, he is wandering within the material world. His acceptance of different types of bodies is brought about by his activities under the influence of the modes of nature. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Actually, the living entity is part and parcel of the Lord, therefore he is spiritual in quality. The living entity is never material, and his material conception is simply a mistake due to forgetfulness. He is as brilliant as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Both the sun and the sunshine are very brilliant. The Lord is like the full shining sun, and the living entities are like the small particles of the sun, which constitute the all-pervasive sunshine. When these small particles are covered by the cloud of Maya, they lose their shining capacity. When the cloud of Maya is gone, the particles again become brilliant and shining. As soon as the living entity is covered by the ignorance of Maya or darkness, he cannot understand his relationship with the Supreme God, Somehow or other, if he comes before the Lord, he can see himself as shining as the Supreme Lord, although he is not as extensive as the Lord. Because the living entity desires to imitate the Supreme Lord, he is covered by Maya. We cannot imitate the Lord, nor can we become the Supreme Enjoyer. God, keep on trying. This is not possible. And when we think it is, we become conditioned by Maya. Thus, the encagement of the living entity under the clutches of Maya is brought about by forgetfulness of his relationship with the Supreme Lord. Under the influence of Maya, the living entity becomes exactly like a person haunted by a ghost. Such a person speaks all kinds of nonsense. When the living entity is covered by the influence of Maya, he becomes a so-called scientist, philosopher, politician, or socialist, and at every moment presents different plans for the benefit of human society. All these plans are ultimately failures because they are illusory. In this way, the living entity forgets his position as an eternal servant of the Lord. He instead becomes a servant of Maya. In any case, he remains a servant. It is his misfortune that by forgetting his real contact with the Supreme Lord, he becomes a servant of Maya. As a servant of Maya, he sometimes becomes a king, sometimes an ordinary citizen, sometimes a Brahmin, a Shudra, and so on. Sometimes he is a happy man, sometimes a prosperous man, sometimes a small insect. Sometimes he is in heaven, and sometimes in hell. Sometimes he is a demigod, and sometimes he is a demon. Sometimes he is a servant, and sometimes a master. In this way, the living entity wanders all over the universe. Only when he comes in contact with the bona fide spiritual master can he understand his real constitutional position. He then becomes disgusted with material existence. At that time, in full Krishna consciousness, he regrets his past experiences of material existence. This regret is very beneficial because it purifies the living entity of material, conditional life. He then prays to the Lord to engage in his service. And at that time, Krishna grants liberation from the clutches of Maya. Lord Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 7, verse 14, Daipyesha gunamai mama maya dharachya mameva ye kripadyante mayam etam taranti te. This divine energy of mind, consisting of the three modes of material nature, is difficult to overcome. But those who have surrendered unto me can easily cross beyond it. Only by the grace of Krishna can we get out of the clutches of Maya. It is not possible to get out by mental speculation or other activities. When the living entity understands his real position by the grace of Krishna, he keeps himself always fit in Krishna consciousness. He keeps himself always fit in Krishna consciousness, new definition of health, and acts accordingly. Thus he gradually becomes completely free from the clutches of Maya. When he is strong in Krishna consciousness, Maya cannot touch him. In this way, in the association of Krishna conscious devotees, the living entity can get free from the contamination of material existence. In this connection, Srila Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami says, Tate Krishna Bhaje Kare Gurum Sevana Maya Jale Chute Paya Krishna Charana. In the Krishna conscious state, the living entity engages in devotional service under the direction of the spiritual master. I think state there means state of consciousness. Not necessarily the Krishna conscious state, country. But anyway, that's another reading. In the Krishna conscious state, the living entity engages in devotional service under the direction of the spiritual master. In this way, he gets out of the clutches of Maya and takes shelter under the lotus feet of Lord Krishna. Chaitanya Charitamrita Madhya Lila, chapter 22, verse 25. Quachit puman quachit chastri, quachin novayam anghihi, deva manusha tiryagva yuta karma gunang bhavaha. Translation again. Covered by the mode of ignorance and material nature, the living entity is sometimes a male, sometimes a female, sometimes a eunuch. Sometimes a human being, sometimes a demigod, sometimes a bird, an animal, and so on. In this way, he is wandering within the material world. His acceptance of different types of bodies is brought about by his activities under the influence of the modes of nature. Omagyana tamarandasa jalandana shalakaya chakshura militang jena tasmai shi gurave namaha vanchakalpa turubhischa kripa sindubhyevacha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Shivasati Gaura Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. In his lecture yesterday, Nimai, who has been renamed by some Nimai Pandit on account of his erudition, mentioned certain categories of three. I think there's also a Shaiva sect. I forget which one it is, someone can remind me. They have, everything is categorized into three. That's their particular philosophy. Everything's in groups of three. I'm not sure if they've stumbled yet, being Shaivas across Jagannath, Baladeva, Subhadra. But that's another three we have. I remember when we were on Sankirtan in the UK, there was one stretch of the motorway used to have three cooling towers. Do you know these cooling towers? Huge, big towers like this where they generate electricity. So it became a tradition on travelling Sankirtan. We developed these ISKCON traditions. But every time we went past these three cooling towers, we go Jagannath, Baladeva, Subhadra, Ki Jai. Anyway, even cooling towers can remind us of Krishna. Anyway, there are categories of three. Nimai mentioned yesterday, and here certain categories are being mentioned. First, the living entity in coming contact with the body. Generally, we ask one of two questions when a child is born: should the clothes be pink or should they be blue? Is it male or is it female? Here a third category is mentioned, which it mentions neither. The third sex, it is sometimes called, the eunuch, is also mentioned. So another set of three. Sometimes male, sometimes female, or sometimes some kind of leaning in between. And then also three planetary systems. The corresponding Triguna. So the three planetary systems correspond to the demigods, Sattvagun, which is overseen by Lord Vishnu. The human existence, the middle planetary system, is the mode, typified by the mode of passion. We're active here, and that's overseen by Lord Brahma, who's responsible for creation, because creation comes about through passion, as in giving birth in this world by that passion. Children are produced. And then finally, the lower mode, the one we try to avoid particularly, particularly during Bhagavatam class, if any of us are sleeping. Tamogun, overseen by Lord Shiva. So different categories of three are mentioned. In this purport, it's a long purport, there are some interesting theological issues discussed. I've identified three, as it happens. First, how the unchanging soul can become conditioned. How the unchanging soul can be described as conditioned or unconditioned if it's unchanging? Because it suggests there's some change. Interesting question. Second, conditioned life is compared to a kind of diseased life, as we've alluded to and particular kind of hero, mental disease, madness. And thirdly, the whole issue of remorse seems to be the conclusion of this purport, and we'll try and explore that a little bit more. Some of the debates about feeling, about guilt and remorse, repentance and so on, because those are probably issues that are relevant to some of us. Firstly, the unchanging soul moves from being conditioned to unconditioned. So how can it be? How can something which is unchanging be described in different ways? It's an interesting question. And of course the answer is that the soul actually doesn't change, but it's covered. And a very interesting metaphor is given, a very apt metaphor, that when a diamond is covered by mud, you don't see the brilliance of the diamond. It's not manifest to us. And as soon as we remove the mud, we see the diamond. Therefore, that analogy is apt to show the diamond hasn't changed as such, but it's covered by mud. It's also interesting that the natural state is one of shining, and therefore we talk of effulgence, brilliance, and so on. And sometimes, perhaps in all religious traditions, there's the idea of the aura and some brilliance coming from saintly people. We can sometimes feel that maybe if we're sensitive to auras. Very powerful as well. It's also interesting, of course, what's relevant here is that the self is full of all good qualities. Those good qualities come from the effulgent self. Even here we can kind of detect that in people. The beauty. Some of it, if we're more sensitive, we detect that beauty comes from outside. These days, of course, can you hear okay? Oh, we have some problem. Maybe I'm moving too much again. Yeah, okay. I'll try not to move too much. To go like this. Okay. Yes. Some interesting points here. I mean, what is extremely relevant is that the qualities of that quality of beauty is within. Sometimes we perceive that, despite the fact that ladies, we have cosmetics and so on. I think men, we have cosmetics now as well, the way the world's going. With some of the blurring between the different genders, as kind of alluded to here. There are many male cosmetics now. But still, we can understand that if a person is... when a person is in a happy state of mind, there is a kind of radiance and beauty that comes from within. Don't we perceive that? And sometimes we're aware ourselves, if we get up late, maybe I don't look so blissful this morning. As a devotee, I'm meant to be blissful, aren't I? Sometimes we're aware of it ourselves. Sometimes we feel that shine, we're more effulgent, and other times we feel less effulgent. Therefore it's said in the Majjhalila Chaitanya Charita, Nitya Siddha Krishna Prem Sadhya Kabanoi Shravanadi Shuddha Chitte Karaya Udai. Pure love for Krishna is eternally established in the hearts of the living entities. It is not something to be gained from another source. When the heart is purified by hearing and chanting, this love naturally awakens. So it's not something to be imposed. It's something to be nurtured from within. And even when there are, in our Krishna consciousness, when there is some instruction given, or there is some discipline, or there is some preaching, it is really to nurture that natural love that is already within the heart. And therefore we are sensitive when we are trying to help others, to make sure we are nurturing that whatever is within. And as human beings, pretty well everyone, most people, at least the innocent, have some understanding of Krishna consciousness, and therefore our duty is to, what's the analogy we use, fanning that spark. Try and fan it. Like we see something that is correct, something that is good, and we try and fan that spark rather than always pointing out the bad. One thing we can learn. Second point here, and we're moving on quite quickly because time is moving us. When the soul loses its purity, it becomes like a person haunted by a ghost. Such ghosts are very impure. In astrology, in Vedic astrology, the planet Rahu rules ghosts. It also rules, it or indicates poison, confusion, madness, phobias or irrational fears. Insects, like cockroaches, dirty. Disease, poison, the malecha class, compulsive habits. Everything, it's a very dirty planet. Very compulsive, dirty. And if anyone's ever had experience of these, what we call our subtle friends, because sometimes they do disturb us, and we may have some dreams. They're very often associated, those dreams, with the, Srila Prabhupada mentions here, in relation to the principles we follow. So those dreams are often associated with the four sinful activities. Mm-hmm. So the pure diamond-like self is covered by the mud of matter, and like a ghost, he becomes mad. Or like a person haunted by a ghost, he becomes mad. That is mentioned, not just mad, but pramata, really mad, bonkers, crazy. Nunam pramata kurate kama yudindriya pitaya apinoti na sadhu manye yata atmano yam asana pikleshida eshadeha ashadeha. This is from the fifth canto of the I think Lord Rishabhadev is speaking here. I think it is, yeah. When a person considers sense gratification the aim of life, he certainly becomes mad after materialistic living and engages in all kind of sinful activity. He does not know that due to his past misdeeds, he has already received a body which, although temporary, is the cause of misery. Actually, the living entity should not have taken on a material body, but he has been awarded the material body for sense gratification. Therefore, I think it not befitting an intelligent man to involve himself again in the activities of sense gratification, by which he perpetually gets material bodies one after another. So really a mad person engages in activities that are not good for his welfare. He engages in activities that are actually detrimental for his own welfare. That's one of the definitions of madness. So there are three aspects of madness. Again, we're using the categories of three. One, he talks all kinds of nonsense. I mean, if we see a mad person, we really don't take that too much notice of them, generally, of what they're saying, at least. We may try to help them, but we don't generally attribute too much importance to their words. I'm just wondering how pure souls see us when we're talking our politics and our philosophy and so on, trying to see how they... Here's an analogy, so we can actually see. An analogy is very useful because it actually changes the way we think. Imagine how we feel when we see a crazy person. I do remember actually when I first joined the movement in Bury Place in London. It was, if anyone remembers Bury Place, it was a very tall, long, tall building, and it had spiral stairs. So I was going up the spiral stairs, and I heard Ribhatananda Swami saying, "So, you are the Jesus Christ?" And when I came around the corner, there was a bearded young hippie gentleman said, "Yes, the Jesus Christ." We'll come to that. Yes, the second point. He thinks he's someone else. He thinks he's someone he's not. Yeah? That is one feature of madness. And thirdly, probably generally we don't think ourselves to be an insignificant person. Therefore, he thinks himself very important. And therefore, often those who are afflicted with some mental disease think they're someone very special. Yeah. Even I know one devotee who started to think he was the next Acharya after Srila Prabhupada, even when Srila Prabhupada was on the planet. So we had to do some preaching there as well. But that is that feeling of grandeur comes also, you know, and wanting to be the Lord of all we survey. But perhaps the most important point, and perhaps relevant to us all to some degree, is the third point here, is that sometimes we regret our madness and our activities. And there's a real interesting question, I think, here. What is remorse, and what is guilt? And what is what some psychologists now call toxic guilt? I don't think it's necessarily, even though this was coined by psychologists, I don't think it's necessarily irrelevant to us. Because there have been devotees, and there probably are devotees, who become overwhelmed, and perhaps it's happened to us on occasion, certainly happened to me, we become overwhelmed with feelings of hopelessness, and sometimes that's accompanied by guilt and so on. It's not been unknown for a devotee to actually commit suicide because of that, actually. There are cases, so it may be something that's such a serious issue for us to look at, is, you know, what is this remorse that is talked about here in the purport, and what is something else, and that kind of guilt that's not helpful, because here Srila Prabhupada makes it very clear that remorse is purifying, and we'll come to that in a minute. So on one hand, I mean, there are different approaches to this, and we find with modern counsellors there tends to be an approach, because we all tend to feel this tension as human beings. The interesting thing is we've got these three levels of existence. The demigods, we've got the human beings, and we've got the animals. Now, the demigods can enjoy without guilt. They're allowed to enjoy. They can even have quite a lot of recreational sexual activities, and there's nothing wrong for them doing that, because they've earned that. A bit like going on holiday. If you've gone on holiday, if you've got a good balance, you can think, yeah, I can go on holiday quite safely, and you don't feel guilty about it. Whereas if your bank balance is pretty tight, you can feel otherwise. So they are actually, they've earned a certain right to enjoy. It may not necessarily be actually pure, completely pure, but at least from within a limited perspective, they enjoy the right to enjoy. The animal, on the other side, can engage in all kinds of sinful activities and needn't feel guilty about it, because that's the body he's got. The human being is somewhere in between, where he's got the animal propensities, but also has conscience. Therefore, it's a very difficult situation, and really he feels uncomfortable in that situation. There's a certain tension. Have you ever seen those doors on your cupboard where you open them, and if you let it go here, it goes back. And if you put it a bit further, it goes up. But if you try and put it in the middle, it doesn't stay there very easily. So the human being doesn't really stay. There's that tension, and he's feeling the pressure. Which way do I go? How do we resolve this tension we have as a human being? Because it's resolved in two ways. Either we destroy our intelligence, the conscience, so that we just enjoy. And that's modern society very much. It's really glorified. I mean, you look at how lust is glorified. This passion is glorified. It really is made out to be something really wonderful. We don't sufficiently acknowledge the problems with sense gratification. We try to solve the problems medically or some other way, particularly with sexual indulgence. So that's the human condition. The other way of getting rid of is actually to elevate, to free ourselves from these pushes. And then that is when we go upwards, we're elevated. Actually here, with regard to guilt, on one hand, and there's a similar thing here, because guilt or conscience and guilt are involved in the process. On one hand, some, and this has been known of a certain counsellors that have been consulted by devotees, they will actually go and the psychologists will tell them, just have sex and don't feel guilty. The problem is the guilt. Mm-hmm. However, I'm going to say there's a little bit of truth in what they're saying, on account of the fact that sometimes we actually let this guilt push us down. And it's, you know, devotees actually become wrapped up in guilt. I mean, there is actually a whole injunction in the scriptures for atonement. When we feel we've done something wrong, there is a process. That is penance. Penance is not the same as austerity. Austerity is accepting hardships. Penance means that actually we perform austerities for the process of purifying ourselves because of some kind of indulgence. And therefore, even after household life, generally during the Vanapras stage of life, there is some penance to purify ourselves. Some kind of atonement. So it is there. It is mentioned. Devata pratimam drishtva yatim chaiva tridandinam namaskaramam chakuryadhyak priyashchitayate naraha. One who does not offer respect to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, to his deity in the temple, or to a Tridandi sannyasi, must undergo priyashchita, atonement. If one does not offer obeisances to such a sannyasi, the prescribed priyashchita is to fast for one day. I remember hearing this when I first came to the movement. If you don't offer obeisances early in the morning to a sannyasi when you first see him, you should fast for the rest of the day. Interesting. And we can meditate on it. There is a whole science of in the morning we actually go to our superiors and pay respects early in the morning. Even the royal class would also do that. They would go to their elders and seek their blessings before doing anything in the day. There's a whole science there. This kind of feeling that I've done something wrong, some kind of priyashchita, is part of our tradition. One of the problems is if we start identifying too much with the guilt, and one of the problems is sometimes we start taking on further material designations. I am the most fallen devotee, as if we're trying to compete or outdo the acharyas. We get this thought in our mind, I'm the most fallen. I am lower than the stool in a worm. Sorry, worm in the stool. We could extend that analogy, yes. If you really want to be lowly, you can go further. I am no good, I am a failure, and all such thoughts. What is this I am this, I am that? We need to watch out for these, what the mind is saying. And often we think this is okay to think that way. But is it? Or are we just simply reinforcing ignorance? We may even develop, you know, the wrong type of humility. Prabhupada says that the proverb, too much humility is the sign of a thief. Criminals and the seedy underworld, it's got that dirty Rahu influence again, contaminated. All nonsense. Basically, we should think, I am the eternal servant of Krishna, full of bliss and knowledge. If you want an affirmation, generally in the new age movement, there's a lot of emphasis on affirmations. So saying positive things about yourself. Actually, recently it was revealed with some university study that if you say these affirmations, it doesn't always have a positive, sometimes has a negative effect if it doesn't match reality. If you say an affirmation, it doesn't actually, you know, if you say, I am rich and multi-billionaire, your bank balance doesn't show that, it'll actually create more problems with the self. So So just a word of warning in case we're into New Age, which I'm sure we're not. But here's an alternative affirmation. I am the eternal servant of Krishna, full of bliss and knowledge. That's actually our natural position. It may be, of course, natural that we feel disgust with ourselves, even after we become Krishna conscious, it may happen. But really, we should ensure that this becomes an impetus of spiritual life, not a burden or an excuse not to. They say, actually, that those people often punish themselves for feeling guilty because they don't really want to do anything. So actually, they keep on feeling that if I feel guilty enough, I won't have to do anything. But the real point is, one guideline that might be useful is when we make a mistake, is to actually look at it. Don't be afraid that we've made a mistake. After all, Srila Prabhupada used to quote, "Failure is the pillar of sin." Just look at it and decide, what did I do? Look at it head on. What did I do wrong? What am I going to do? And then pray to the Supreme Lord not to make that again. So it requires some courage to do that. So basically, there seem to be three kind of responses to this issue of remorse or guilt. Again, coming back to the three. One is to give up guilt and be happy in sinful life, which is not easy for devotees. Although, mentioning one thing, we should sometimes be careful. There's certain things we shouldn't feel guilty about. We should be careful that sometimes the mind is tricking us and we're feeling guilty about something we shouldn't be guilty. Actually, even Chanakya Pandit said, actually, you shouldn't be shy about eating nicely and dressing nicely. Don't be shy about those things. He said also intimate relationships with one's legal wife. One should be shy. Those things are okay. Sometimes we have to accept things. We shouldn't feel guilty unnecessarily. But still, the whole idea that's given to us by some counsellors that we actually engage in sinful life and the guilt is the problem is not right. On the other hand, the other extreme, to become bound up in guilt and completely rolling in the mud, is not useful to us. We need to admit it becomes self-indulgent and inappropriate. And the third option, the correct approach, is to feel remorse and become determined not to act inappropriately again. This remorse is in itself purifying, as mentioned. And I'll read the verse from the Srimad Bhagavatam to finish off. Tate kampam su samikshamano banjata evatma kritam vipakam kridva kupur pir vidhan namaste jivetu yo mukte pade sadaya vak. My dear Lord, one who earnestly awaits for you to bestow your causeless mercy upon him, all the while patiently suffering the reactions of his past misdeeds, and offering you respectful obeisances within his heart, words, and body, is surely eligible for liberation, for it has become his rightful claim. Very important. And it may happen that we fail, and we fail, and we fail. And sometimes our own failure is harder to deal with than the miseries of this world. This is really important. We just have to somehow carry on in devotional service and persevere. Srila Sridhara Swami, and I'll finish in 2 minutes, Srila Sridhara Swami explains in his commentary that just as a legitimate son has to simply remain alive, that's all he has to do to gain his inheritance. That's all he has to do. If he dies, well, tough, he won't get it. Will go to someone else. But all he's got to do is remain alive. One who simply remains alive in Krishna consciousness, following the regulative principles of Bhakti Yoga, automatically becomes eligible to receive the mercy of the personality of Godhead. We have to stay alive, even if sometimes our Krishna consciousness, we feel, and it's healthy to feel, is not on the level that we want it to be. And sometimes grihasthas become really perplexed when they find they can't maintain the same level of sadhana as a brahmacharic. But what do you expect? That's to be accepted. There's going to be a bit more struggle in grihastha life. Here there is a very good standard of sadhana on this exemplary, but still, we can expect there's going to be a little bit of a problem. And when we get married, particularly, it'll be more difficult. It's always difficult, isn't it? Sadhana? Does anyone find it really easy? Who wakes up at 4:30 and thinks, yippee, mangalati? I did at one point. I was in Soho Street. I don't know what happened. I have no idea what happened. I have no idea why it happened. But the first month I was there, I used to wake up and think, yippee, mangalati. Maybe Krishna's mercy. I was really enthusiastic to get it. Yeah. We have to keep going. So really, even it's almost healthy to feel, yes, my sadhana and so on is not good enough. But it shouldn't become, we shouldn't become so depressed. And Srila Prabhupada, we just need to stay alive in Krishna consciousness. Stay alive. Stick it out for the long period. Even though we feel we may not be on the highest level, but we have to stay in Krishna consciousness for the long run. And Srila Prabhupada mentions, just to finish, in the Bhagavad Gita chapter 3, verse 31, at the end of the purport, which is about performing one's duty, I think, 331. In the beginning of Krishna consciousness, one may not fully discharge the injunctions of the Lord, but because one is not resentful of this principle that we should follow the injunctions, and works sincerely without consideration of defeat and hopelessness, he will surely be promoted to the stage of pure Krishna consciousness. Questions, please. Hare Krishna.
In the last event you read, Srila Prabhupada was saying, all we need is to bring a light of Krishna consciousness. So then naturally the next question that comes up is, well, what does it mean to be a light of Krishna consciousness? How do we know we're alive and dead?
We should know whether we're alive. It means really to follow the regulative principles, and just at least to strive to follow them. Hopelessness means we give up, basically. When we become hopeless, we give up. Oh, it's not worth it, I'm not going to bother. So at least striving, at least there should be some struggle. Yeah, we should have life also. We should be introspective to see, are we alive? Are we vibrant? Are we happy to be alive? Or do we think life is a drag? Embodied life may be difficult, true. But life itself is joyful. Naturally. And therefore even assume, even though we're embodied, we still have that kind of conviction that life is somehow for enjoyment. It is. But we just don't know how to enjoy. So somehow or other we keep ourselves alive by working sincerely and not being resentful of the principle. In other words, we do try and follow. We don't start to become resentful of the principle and think, actually the principles are problematic to us. We've got to do this, we've got to do that. It's easy to become resentful. Why? Why should I? Does anyone else want to cast any light on that, what it means to be alive? Dina Dayal Prabhu.
I don't know if you know, but one thing came to my mind is, in fact, the holy name. The principle is fine, but without the holy name, there's our everyday activity and focus in our life. This means a lot, at least for me. I heard many times it's happening in our life, ups and downs, but don't give up the holy name. And of course, to keep the holy name, you have to keep principles, and you have to keep many more. So this man is doing.
Yeah, no, you're right. I forgot that. I forgot the holy name. Excuse me. We take a vow at initiation to avoid four regular principles and chant around. Actually, one interesting point is we actually take a vow to become Krishna conscious. It's important to keep that in mind. It really is what we're doing. We're taking those vows, but we're also taking vows to become. And it's important to keep that long-term goal. If we just see it in terms of 4 acre principles or 16 rounds, it can become very numeric. Not 3, but 4 and 16. Right? And that's not really our point is to become Krishna conscious, and that means we become alive. So the point is, I mean, what's my own experience of this? My own experience is when we're having difficulty spiritually, and it can be very difficult, we actually have the perception that there's only really one way to go, and that's forward. There is no other way, in the sense, right? What are we going to do? Retreat from the... It may be that we take another... our level of Krishna consciousness, at least externally, may not be that high. But it says here, one may not fully discharge the injunctions of the Lord. But because one is not resentful of this principle and works sincerely without consideration of defeat and hopelessness, if we try and become a pure devotee overnight, we're going to become disappointed. That's the fact. We need to have a long-term goal. Yeah. Vasudev Prabhu.
When you mention to be alive, it brings to me somewhere beyond just survival. Mm. Because we may also get into the survival mode where we just barely make it. Just barely chant our rounds, and we don't actually struggle to fix the mind on the holy name, for example. Mm. So this survival mode is a refuge that is tempting to the false ego. That if I just somehow or other survive, I'll be all right. But actually, it's not good enough. Like Prabhupada used to say, there's no stagnation. Mentioned moving forward. You move forward and not just to stagnate. To say, okay, I'm okay now. If I just stay where I am, I'll be all right. This is a false...
Sure. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. We need to strive for Krishna consciousness. But at the same time, the other point is, on the other side, sometimes we become over heavy on ourselves because we're not reaching the platform expected of us or we expect of ourselves. And then what happens? We give up at some point. That's when it becomes a challenge. When we give up at some point, the tension becomes too much, we decide to give up. That's not recommended. So even sometimes we may change a little bit. For example, the brahmacharya may change his ashram. But that's okay. We're in it for the long run. And then having this long vision is important. But yes, of course, being alive, I think you've made the point very rightly, means struggle. Why was Bhagavad Gita spoken on a battlefield? Interesting meditation, really. Not after speaking the Gita, Krishna told Arjuna, it's okay, go home, chant your rounds. After hearing the Gita, he had to fight for 18 days. The idea of struggling is there. That it's good to struggle. So if we feel we're struggling, take it as a positive sign. Take it as a positive sign. I was chanting it this morning when I was sitting next to you. I nearly turned and spoke to you, but I thought I'd better leave you in your meditation. But I was going to say, it's hard work, isn't it, chanting rounds? And it should be hard work, because as you said, when we give up, or we're in survival mode, is almost giving up. But we should always bring the mind back. Bring the mind back. We're always trying. Okay. Let's finish there, because time's moved on. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.